thousand spiders crawling all around her. She knew this all too well. Something was different this time, Dahlia sensed, though she couldn't quite sort it out. She could feel the filaments winding around her, binding her to the web wall behind her, holding up her outstretched arms. Those arms were straighter than before, perfectly outright, and she could not bend them at all. That was the difference. The drow had put a pole across her shoulders. No, not a pole, Dahlia then realized, to her shock. It was Kozah's needle, her staff. They had armed her. For a moment, she thought that a grave mistake by her captors, thought that she could tear free of the webs and attack this Zorlaran priestess standing before her. But no, she could not. She then came to understand, as the strands pulled against her, pulled her to her tiptoes, then lifted her off the ground altogether. She hung there, swaying. The spiders continued their work, covering her with webs. The Illithid approached her, tentacles waggling. Her screams began anew. A long while later, she hung limply and knew no more.
"She is yours now,"
Methil Elvidenvelp telepathically imparted to Berylip. He methodically turned and walked off to the side, to the walkway that would take him to the antechamber across the gorge.
"A fitting ornament to complete your chapel,"
Methil's watery voice said in Berylip's mind, and in the minds of all the others in the room. A wry grin spread on Berylip's face as the spiders continued their work, cocooning Dahlia. They busily crawled across her face, weaving their filament strands. Dahlia opened her blue eyes wide with shock. Under the mask, her face contorted in a hopeless, muffled scream. Berylip stared at her unblinking. It would not do to laugh aloud, the priestess understood, as the solemn ceremony neared its end. With a look to the great jade spiders on either end, Berylip sharply clapped her hands, and those magical arachnids began drawing in the strands, which reached up and looped over an unseen beam amidst the cobwebs, and the cocooned Dahlia began to lift higher. She went up at a slight angle, leaning forward as she came against the web wall. Against and into the web wall she went. Just an outline then. Just an ornament in the Kuzorlaran chapel, a tortured and imprisoned Darthir, forever to look down at the sacrificial altar. "In this place, eternally in death, may you witness the sacrifice of many of your foul kind," Berylip prayed. Dahlia couldn't hear her. Dahlia couldn't hear anything. Chapter 22 Stokely's Stand.
"We have killed a score and captured a dozen," Tiago lamented.
"They are not easily taken alive," Ravel Zorlaran replied. "Our poison hardly slows them, and they will fight even when grievously wounded. Foul dwarves."
"We came for slaves, but find corpses instead," Tiago fumed.
"We came for Drizzt,"
Ravel reminded him.
"It was likely long gone now that word has passed ahead."
The wizard gave a little laugh, and Tiago glared at him murderously.
"Drizzt O'Urden would not flee by any accounts of his reputation," Ravel wisely explained, easing the sudden tension a bit.
"Nay, he is up there with the dwarf leader, this Stokely creature, whose name is the last word uttered by the dwarfs as they fall."
Ravel wisely left off the rest of his thought, that Drizzt had not been here since long before the attack. He had interrogated a few of the dwarf prisoners, and as far as he could tell, they were not lying when they had divulged the news of Drizzt's departure. But Tiago didn't need to know that little tidbit, he thought, for without the coveted prize, the impulsive young Beanri would likely call off the attack and head back for Kuzorlaran. That would not be a good choice, Ravel believed. They had lost several drow and a drider, and Matron Xerath would not be pleased with that price for the gain of a few slaves. Even more important,
They had lost Jarth, the weapons master of House Zor-Lauren, the head of the Zor-Lauren garrison, and one of Xerath's favored minions. If they returned now with this meager offering of slaves, Matron Xerath would be outraged. She couldn't fault or punish Tiago, of course, given his nobility and protectors. And since Sarabel was now to be his wife and had been ordered to return with him to Menzo Berenzon by Matron Mother Quenthal herself, Matron Xerath likely wouldn't exact any punishment upon Sarabel either. The only other targets upon whom Ravel could deflect the responsibility, Berylip and Eurynome, had remained in Cus Orlaren. That left Ravel to feel the weight of Matron Xerath's anger. They, indeed he, needed more slaves and a greater victory to present to Matron Xerath to overcome her inevitable anger over losing Jarth.
"We press on," Ravel advised. "There is greater treasure to be found among the higher levels of this complex."
"Treasure and slaves, let us hope," Tiago started to say, but did not finish, for halfway through his sentence, the corridor began to shake and rumble, dust and stones falling from the ceiling. It became so violent that at one point, Ravel began casting a contingency spell to transport him far away. The shaking stopped before he cast the spell, though, and he and Tiago both understood that some other nearby tunnel had likely collapsed. Side by side, Tiago on his subterranean lizard and Ravel on a created floating disc, the two nobles moved ahead to join up with their defensive line. But they were met after only a few steps by a frantic young drow female.
"The ceiling has fallen upon them,"
she cried, pointing frantically to a side tunnel and one with a cloud of dust and debris billowing out.
"Oh, these devil dwarves!"
The noble drow picked up their pace and swept into the side tunnel, crossing just a short distance before coming to the intersection with a tunnel that ran parallel to the one in which they had been standing. Piles of rock blocked their way, and a swarm of dark elves and goblins dug at the stones frantically. Ravel tapped Tiago on the shoulder and guided his glance across the way, to where a drider leg protruded from the collapsed mound, twitching in the crushed creature's death throes.
"How many?" Tiago yelled at the dark elves, scrambling around the rubble.
"Several at least, Lord Banry," one answered.
"A trio of driders," another added.
"And a host of goblin fodder," said a third from far across the way.
"Rigged to collapse," Ravel remarked.
"This is a formidable enemy, and they know we've come now. We will battle for every room and corridor."
"No," Tiago replied. "Find a way, you and your mages, find a way. We must be done with this, and quickly."
Ravel started to argue, but remembered his own predicament here and knew that Tiago's advice was doubly important for his own standing and perhaps for his own health. He went to confer with the wizards he had brought along on this expedition. Within an hour, a dozen magical constructs, disembodied giant eyeballs, floated along the corridors of the dwarven complex as the drow mages took a full reconnoiter of the complex. They had come in here without proper respect for the dwarf's resilience and readiness, but they would not make that mistake again.
"Words out to Lonelywood,"
a dwarf runner reported to Stokely Silverstream.
"Her boats are out, though, and it'll be a bit to bring 'em back in."
"Same with other lake towns,"
another dwarf remarked.
"It's all on Bryn Shander,"
Stokely told them, and they nodded their agreement. Bryn Shander wasn't built on the banks of any of the lakes, and so her garrison was always at the ready. Still, it would be many hours before any sizable force of reinforcements could arrive.
"We'll need to hold stronger. Then hold strong some more when them Bryn Shander boys get here,"
Stokely explained.
"The boys from the lakes'll be coming in later, and here's hoping that them boys out in East Haven can find a barbarian tribe or two to tow along for the fight."
"Hey ho to that," a dwarf cheered.
"Not taking much to convince a barbarian to fight, eh?" said another. "That's why I'm liking them tall boys."
Many fists began to pump at that proclamation, and Stokely even offered a nod of encouragement. The battle had started as a rout that morning, but the heroic run of Junkie and the brave sacrifices of those dwarves who stood behind him and held back the drow line had given the dwarves a fighting chance. These were battle hammers, and to a dwarf they had seen years of combat. Construction of the bulk of the tunnels of the complex had been overseen by King Brunner himself, along with his most trusted and veteran shield dwarves, and so had been built for defense above all else. The drow had come on quickly, but Stokely's boys had been ready to meet that charge, and more important, Stokely's tunnels had been ready to drop in the face of that advance.
"We keep 'em locked down below, and we'll turn 'em back, don't ye doubt," he told the dwarves around him. "Aye, and might that we then chase 'em back all the way to Gontalgrim," said another. "Huzzah!"
"Huzzah!" cried the others, and Stokely nodded. And then five of the dwarves near the wall to Stokely's left fell away suddenly as the floor beneath their feet simply vanished. And the wall across the room disappeared, and huge javelins came flying into the gathering, and huge driders charged in behind the volley, a horde of goblins close behind.
"Breach!" Stokely and several others all cried out together,
and the dwarves began to scramble, forming defensive lines. The room's conventional doors banged open, and more battle hammers charged into the fray. The audience chamber's walls echoed with the cries of battle, the ring of metal on metal. Stokely ran to the unexpected pit and slid down to his knees beside its edge, other dwarves joining in, including several with ropes and grapnels. The sheer walls, so sheer and smooth, it was as if the stone had simply vanished, fell away for more than 20 feet to a lower tunnel running beneath the audience chamber. And there lay the broken dwarves, two looking dead, two crawling, and one pulling himself back to his feet, having survived the fall. Stokely started to call down to him, but the poor fellow began to jerk this way and that, and it took a moment for Stokely to register that the dwarf was being hit with missiles, hand crossbow bolts likely. A brilliant flash of sizzling light defeated Stokely's next attempt to call out as a lightning bolt stole the darkness. And when it passed, only one dwarf was still trying to crawl, and none were standing. Over went the ropes, dwarfs leaping onto them to rappel down to their kin. Stokely, too, took a rope in hand.
"No, no," cried another dwarf, a priestess named Brimble, who was one of Stokely's most trusted advisers.
Stokely paused and looked to her for an explanation while others began their descent.
"It's a magical passwall," Brimble cried. "They can dispel—"
Before she even finished, Stokely felt the weight of the rope disappear, and as he stumbled back a bit, overbalanced by the suddenly diminished weight, he looked to the pit that wasn't a pit any longer, but simply the floor, as it had been. And dwarves had started down there. Several of those brave dwarves lay on the floor now, right next to Stokely, having been ejected from the tunnel that was not a tunnel.
"Where's McGritz? He was on the rope ahead of me,"
one cried, leaping up to his feet, and two others expressed similar concerns for dwarves ahead on their respective ropes as well.
"In the tunnel below, then,"
Brimble replied. Stokely threw down his rope and drew out his battle axe from over his shoulder.
"Plenty to hit here, then," he cried,
and led the charge into the side of the Drider goblin line. More dwarves poured in from the side tunnels, but so too came the drow, and the dwarves hacking through the goblin ranks soon found more formidable foes, quicker and more deadly, and far more skilled with the blade. The advance bogged down, the lines dissipated, and the room became a tumble of confusion, with battles in every corner.
"A blade wins a duel, but magic wins a battle," Ravel said to Tiago as they neared the battle.
"How long will our tunnel remain?" Tiago asked.
"The better part of the night unless we choose to remove it," the confident mage replied.
No sooner had the words left his mouth, though, than the last expanse of that magically created tunnel became stone once more. And in the corridor not far from the two drow nobles, several other drow, ejected by the lapsing magic, pulled themselves to their feet. Tiago turned a scowl on his companion.
"They have priests," Ravel explained, and calmly, as if this was a not unexpected complication. "To more conventional tunnels, then. We have scouted them extensively and will find our way."
His calm was not persuasive, though, and Tiago continued to scowl as he swung his lizard mount around and waved for the others to follow him, and quickly. Ravel called ahead to a pair of his fellow wizards, and they ran off, leading the way and motioning for the main drow contingent to follow. Ravel and his magical peers had indeed scouted the tunnels in this part of the dwarven complex, and could make their way to the throne room through more conventional routes.
"We will get there,"
the brash Zor-Lauren wizard told Tiago. What he didn't add, however, was that it would take some time, likely more time than those forces caught in the throne room could afford. Tiago's returning look, however, showed that he saw right through that phony confidence. A dozen drow, a handful of driders, and a few score of goblins had gotten into the throne room, the main dwarf stronghold, before the passwall tunnel had been dispelled. A powerful force by most standards, they were up against the bulk of the fierce dwarves of the complex and were without magical aid. The young Baenri warrior was trained enough and seasoned enough to understand what they'd likely find when they reached that stronghold. Tiago grimaced and cursed the clever dwarves when the ground rumbled in the distance as more rigged tunnels collapsed. The dozen and two goblins fleeing the battle, which had become a rout, almost made it out of the room. But as they finally breached the door, they found not an open corridor waiting for them, but a quartet of grim-faced dwarves, holding firm in the narrow exit, two abreast and two deep. The lead goblins hesitated, but their frantic kin pushed them ahead, and even when they were dead, one skull split by a battle axe, the other crushed by a warhammer, those leading goblins remained upright, pinned between the crush of their desperate kin and the braced shields of the sturdy dwarves.
"Can't hold 'em,"
warned Tregor Hornbrook, a yellow-bearded shield dwarf in the front rank. He lowered his shoulder some more and managed a weak swing of his heavy hammer, but had to retract it immediately to doubly brace the shield against the press. He was the largest and strongest dwarf under Kelvin's cairn, so those words struck an alarm indeed. The corridor widened just beyond the door, and if the goblins got through that bottleneck, they'd swarm. His companion beside him grunted, too strained to even articulate his concern. To the surprise of Tregor and his struggling sidekick, the two in the second rank didn't press in more tightly, but suddenly ran off.
"How now?" Tregor roared at them, and the other dwarf grunted again.
A goblin spear propped in between the shields then, nicking Tregor's shoulder, and the sting just made him set himself more firmly and push back with all his considerable strength.
"Back!" came the call behind him, and the two returned, and Tregor understood when black-shafted pole arms prodded out beside him, stabbing past the dead goblins to weaken the press behind. "Well thinked!" Tregor congratulated.
For just back of their position stood some stone statues, and the artists had completed the sentry sculptures with actual pole arms, albeit of simple iron instead of prized mithril or adamantine. Despite the desperate situation, Tregor couldn't help but chuckle when the pole arm stabbed past him again, and he noted a stone hand, broken off at the wrist, still grasping the iron shaft. The goblins came on again more furiously, and the shield dwarves began to slide once more, and the pair behind them stabbed with abandon, trying to break the press. They could not, though, despite the goblin blood pooling on the floor, and for a brief moment the four thought their position surely lost. But then the press disappeared, and the four soon realized it to be the last desperate move of the fleeing goblins, as Stokely and his boys caught up to them inside the room.
"Well fought!"
Stokely congratulated when the last of the wretched goblins breathed its last. Tregor looked past him into the throne room to note the carnage. It was hard to visually separate the bodies enough to determine where one torn corpse ended and the next began, so tight had been the fighting. Despite that chaos, the young warrior dwarf noted many of his kin among the piles of dead.
"The drow have gained this level and own everything below it,"
Brimble said, running up to Stokely.
"Where are they coming up?"
Stokely asked.
"East stair, but—"
Brimble replied, and she ended there, and with a bit of a sigh, reminding Stokely of the pit that had appeared in the throne room. With their passwall spells and other magic, was there really a line of battle to be drawn? Stokely looked to Tregor and his three companions, then glanced down the tunnel behind them, which led to the uppermost area of the complex and the outer door.
"What word?"
he asked hopefully.
"Bryn Shander's hours away,"
Tregor grimly reported.
if the folk are even comin', I mean. 3 hours of sunlight left,
Brimble reminded him, and in looking at her plaintive expression, both Stokely and Tregor understood her intent.
Nah, Tregor boomed, and those around him catching on began to shake their heads.
But Stokely Silverstream looked back into the throne room, where at least a score of his kin lay dead, and several more had fallen through the vanished floor, surely dead or captured. They had fought terrifically by any measure, and the goblins lay dead by the dozen, and a few monstrous striders dominated the scene, upturned and with their ugly spider legs curled upward. And Drow had died. But Stokely had seen those fights, and indeed had been in one of them. It took two of his boys to kill every drow, it seemed, and even then it would not be an easy fight.
"Call in every outpost! Gather 'em all!" he called out to all around. "We'll make for the daylight in the dale, and them damned drow won't follow!"
Not a dwarf moved, but many sets of disappointed eyes stared back at him. He had just called for them to abandon their home, something no dwarf was ever wont to do.
"We'll be back!" Stokely promised. "And we'll have the garrisons of the towns and a horde of barbarians aside us. Don't ye doubt."
Several dwarves began to nod.
"Now get ye going,"
Stokely ordered, and that broke the trance and all began to scramble. But then the darkness came, blinding them all, and even the lightning bolt sizzling through the magical blackness and the brilliant flaming bursts of fireballs could not be seen, but surely felt. Stokely Silverstream and Brimble staggered into a side room to catch their breath.
"Junkie's down,"
Brimble said. She leaned on a chair by the door off the main corridor, where Stokely raced across the room to a second door. He cracked it open.
"Way's clear,"
he said, turning back to face her.
"This'd be a better run to the front door."
Even as he spoke the words, they stung him profoundly. His group had been routed and scattered in and about the throne room, overwhelmed by the dark elven magic and spinning blades in the darkness. Now it was every dwarf for himself, something no clan leader ever wanted to face. He knew Brimble's words to be true. Junkie and some others had been catching up, but alas, they hadn't made it. Now the best Stokely could hope for was to get out of the complex and round up some reinforcements to try to take it back. But even that didn't exactly inspire, for how many of his dwarves would be left to inhabit the place? Yes, it seemed to Stokely Silverstream in that dark moment that the centuries-long domain of Clan Battlehammer in Icewind Dale had come to its end.
"Come on, then," he called.
Brimble just stared at him unblinking.
"Lass,"
he asked, and took a step toward her. He stopped fast when a pair of dark elves pushed in through the door behind Brimble. A male and a female, both superbly outfitted, particularly the male, whose sword and shield both glistened, nearly translucent, and seemed as if they had captured the very stars within their depths.
"Where will you run, dwarf?"
the male drow asked, stepping past Brimble without a care. And only then did Stokely fully appreciate that his dear cleric friend had fallen victim to a spell she often used, and was magically, fully held in place. The drow warrior lifted his sword out to the side, in line with poor Brimble's throat.
"Run, then," he bade Stokely. "She will feel the pain, I assure you, and she will die slowly."
"Save yourself. Perhaps you will get away," said the female,
moving up to cruelly stroke Brimble's hair. Her command of the surface language was not so strong, and her accent thick, so that it took Stokely a few heartbeats to decipher her words.
"But you will know that you fled and left your friend to die," the male added, "until the darkness of death mercifully releases you from your private torment."
Stokely Silverstream turned back from the door and banged his axe against his shield.
"Come on, then,"
he bade the drow warrior as he stepped back toward the middle of the room.
"Or are ye too afeard to fight me alone?"
"I?"
the drow asked, moving forward to meet the challenge.
"Do you not know who I am, dwarf?"
Stokely leaped ahead, axe swinging as he went for the quick kill. which would be his only chance to save Brimble and hustle her away, obviously. The drow's shield seemed to roll around, and each circuit made it larger. And though Stokely had aimed to drop his axe over the top of the blocker, by the time it connected, the shield was large enough to fully defeat the attack. Stokely fell off to that side, his right, and tucked his own shield in tight to block the stab of the drow's sword. The fine magical blade cut right through a wooden plank, but the adamantine bands of the shield held, just barely, Stokely realized as he disengaged and glanced down. One of the bands had been cut halfway across. "I have killed a Baelor at the gates of the city," the drow boasted, just as Stokely began his next advance. "Is the name of Tiago so quickly forgotten?" That stopped the dwarf in his tracks. "Yes, dwarf," the drow went on. "Tiago, friend of Drizzt."
"No friend of Drizzt," the dwarf declared. "Drizzt is friend to Clan Bat— Nay, Drizzt is of Clan Battlehammer."
In he charged, axe swinging and chopping wildly as he moved through his best attack routines. At one point, he cut his weapon viciously across and let himself get pulled in the wake. He came around with his shield angled sidelong to strike at the drow if he tried to advance behind the axe cut, then came all the way around ready to strike again. But the drow was gone, and Stokely wisely threw himself forward, barely avoiding the stabbing sword. "Nay, foolish dwarf," said the drow, who had been quick enough to get out to the side halfway through Stokely's pirouette. "Drizzt is of House Doerden, ever of House Doerden, ever of Menzo Berenzon." And now the drow came on, pressing the attack, his sword stabbing forward in rapid succession as he powerfully advanced. Stokely could only hope his shield would hold as he blocked the repeated thrusts and stepped back furiously. Finally he caught his balance enough to counter, and out went his axe with all his considerable strength behind it. It creased into the drow's shield, but to Stokely it seemed more like he had struck a feather mattress, for the blow did not sound or feel sharp, but muted. He couldn't begin to fathom the material of that shield, and his confusion became even more complete when he tried to pull the blade back but found it stuck fast. He hesitated, staring blankly. A drow sword slashed against his extended elbow, and Stokely let go of his weapon and retracted the torn arm. On came the drow, and up went Stokely's shield, and the dwarf's mind whirled as he considered how he might retrieve his axe, still stuck fast to that curious shield, or wondered where he might flee to gain another weapon. Perhaps he could pull Brimble's mace from her frozen hand. Or perhaps, he quickly understood, he could do no such thing. The drow came on with such a fury that Stokely could not dodge left or right, or even retreat after the few steps he took that put his back up against the room's wall. And there, trapped, he tried to cover. But this one was too proficient, too skilled, and too well armed. Stokely blocked a series of sudden, powerful thrusts that cracked and flecked the wood of his shield, and a pair of heavy downward chops that creased the adamantine ring that bound the materials in place. Another thrust got through the breaking blocker and severed one of the many arm straps that secured it to Stokely's forearm, and cut a nice line in the dwarf's sleeve and skin as well. The shield fell to pieces. Stokely threw it at the drow and threw himself at the drow behind it. He felt the burning explosion of the sword slash across his face in mid-leap, and reached out as he descended, determined to grab hold of the drow. But Tiago was already off to the side, and Stokely landed and staggered and groped at the empty air. The next explosion knocked the dwarf's helm free and cracked the back of his skull, adding to the angle of his forward lean and to his momentum, and he pitched headlong to the stone floor, pitched headlong into darkness. And so the Battle of Kelvin's Cairn did end, and Tiago Beanri could rightfully claim victory. But it was a hollow cheer, the noble drow knew as his kin began looting and rounding up the newfound slaves, for Drizzt O'Erden was nowhere to be found. And Jarth Zorlaren, weapons master of Q'Zorlaren, remained very much dead. Chapter 23. The Delicate Balance.
The grin on Gromp Beanri's face did little to calm the Armgo nobles standing around the throne room of Matron Mesbaris.
"The husband of Manolin Fay graces us with his presence,"
High Priestess Teyrul announced to her matron, and Gromp understood that the slight had certainly been practiced by Teyrul and approved by Mesbaris. Teyrul was a sniveling little witch after all, and would never expose herself to the wrath of Gromp without her powerful mother's blessing and indeed demand.
"By the determination of Lady Lolth herself," Gromp replied, and lightly, as if taking the insult without a care. "I would be a poor servant to ignore the Spider Queen's direct command, and a fool to ignore her determination that my child will be favored."
"Child?"
Matron Mesbaris asked. Gromp merely smiled wider.
"Then you will elevate Manolin Fay to matron of House Beanri, perhaps,"
Mesbaris pressed.
"Now that your sister Sosamtu has been moved on to serve in House de Werden, the path to ascent seems rather simple."
"The path to ascent would go through Matron Mother Quenthal," Gromp replied. "Hardly simple, for there is no more difficult path to walk in all of Menzo Berenzon."
"Difficult, yes, but we have a way."
Gromp matched the matron's sly look with a smirk and chuckle, which had the ever-wary Princess Teyrul staring hard at him, and across from her, weapons master Malagdorl, an impulsive oaf, even took a threatening step Gromp's way, his hand going to his sword hilt.
"You have already had this discussion with Priestess Manolin," Gromp said.
"Are we to pretend that our many plans never happened?"
"That would be wise, yes."
"Or perhaps I will go to Matron Mother Quenthal and tell her of your designs against her,"
Matron Mesbaris warned.
"Yes, let us go forthwith,"
Gromp casually replied, and that had the nobles of Barriss and Delarmgo whispering and looking at him curiously.
"Or better, perhaps."
The archmage paused and began some spell casting. Malakdorl drew his weapon. Teyrul began to pray, and Matron Mesbaris leaped from her chair at the affront. To enter the audience chamber of a rival house and cast a spell unbidden by and in the presence of the matron. Gromp paused and looked at Mesbaris incredulously. He shifted his gaze just a bit to the side, to Malakdorl, and the archmage's smile reappeared, and this time it was one threatening a sudden and brutal death.
"You don't need to be so on edge, Matron of Barriss and Delarmgo," Gromp assured her. "Though if your weapons master advances another stride, you will need to replace him."
Matron Mesbaris glared at her impetuous son and hissed at him until he moved back beside the throne and sheathed his great sword.
"This is a time of unity," Gromp explained. "View every step the Matron Mother has recently taken through that prism, and you will see the reasoning of her design."
"Will House Malarn agree with that assessment?"
"House Malarn?"
Gromp asked innocently, and Mesbaris narrowed her eyes. She wanted to call him out, the archmage knew, but she could not. If she elaborated on the affront to House Malarn, she would, at the same time, be admitting that House Malarn had put those soldiers and driders into the abandoned and sequestered House Doerden, in clear violation of the orders of the ruling council. She would even be hinting at her own complicity in creating the garrison the Beanris had cleared from that restricted house, for surely there were Barriss and Delarmgo soldiers among that garrison. Such open secrets could never be admitted, even if all knew the truth.
"The Malarni ascend to the sixth house with the departure of the Zorlarins,"
Gromp replied.
"That will satisfy eager Matron Jindia.
They are more powerful than houses ranked higher, and they are more devout,"
Mesbaris reminded him.
"If Matron Jindia is as devout as you claim, and I do not dispute that," he quickly added, seeing Mesbaris's scowl,
then she will know that the Spider Queen will not sanction any inter-house warfare at this time. Indeed, should she move against Fey Branch, she will find houses Mizrim and Feanthlabar allied with her enemy. Trin scowled more profoundly, clearly anticipating Gromp's next remark. And all of them allied with House Beenri. Our entire might will turn against House Melarn and destroy Jindia's family as fully as Matron Mother Ivanel destroyed House Oblodra in the time of troubles. Do not doubt that the Spider Queen would favor this.
Have you come here to threaten?
Quite the opposite, Matron.
Gromp cut her short and offered a bow as he spoke. When he came up, he lifted his arms in the same pose as when he was spellcasting earlier. He froze there and looked to Matron Mesbaris for permission to continue. Malak Dorl was already leaning forward again, his face a scowl, and how Gromf wanted to simply make him vanish, to obliterate him to nothingness. The Archmage remembered that he was an ambassador here, and settled for the fantasy of melting the impudent weapons master. Matron Mesbaris held up her hand to hold Malak Dorl back, then motioned for Gromf to continue. The Archmage began to chant softly. His fingers glowed with black energy, and he drew a doorway in front of him, trailing lines of blackness as substantial as if he had been painting on a canvas. The completed lines shimmered and sparked and bled blackness within the square Gromf had drawn, until the whole shimmered like a curtain, a black portal. Mesbaris and her children and all the Armgo guards stood ready, many glancing around as if expecting an open portal to the abyss itself, as if expecting a horde of demons to come roaring into their audience chamber. But it was no horde, just a solitary figure. And that figure was not demonic, but was, rather, a drow. A female drow, the matron mother of Menzo Berenzon. In glancing around, it occurred to perceptive Gromp that the nobles of this second house, looking at the spectacle of Matron Mother Quenthel, would have been less shocked if it had been the demon horde instead.
Matron Mesbaris, am I welcomed in your home this day?
The Matron Mother asked. The Matron of Barrison del Armgo stared at her arch-rival, not knowing what to make of any of this. She swallowed hard as her gaze slipped to the portal, still shimmering, still open. Her expression revealed her fear. Was there a Beenri army ready to pour through at the Matron Mother's command?
Of course, Matron Mother. If you come in the name of the Spider Queen,
Mesbaris properly replied.
I am the Matron Mother of Menzo Berenzon, Quenthel imperiously replied. Where I go, so goes the Spider Queen in name and in heart.
Yes, Matron Mother,
Mesbaris replied, stammering just a bit in surprise, and she wisely lowered her gaze. Quenthel's assertion of power had hit the perfect tone, Gromf understood, and he did well to hide his grin.
There is no threat here, Matron of Barris and Del Armgo,
the Matron Mother said.
I am here in solidarity and alliance. We look outward now. The Spider Queen will not accept intrigue among her matrons, not now. You are under House Beenri's protection.
Gromf held his breath at that explosive remark, and he saw the expressions of Mesbaris and her two children tightening immediately yet again.
We do not need Beenri's protection, the proud Mesbaris retorted, but Quenthel went on undeterred.
And House Beenri is under yours, she said, stealing her counterpart's bluster.
Indeed, Matron Mesbaris stammered indecipherably for a few moments. Now Gromf did smile and almost chuckled. Quenthel was playing her. She had moved Mesbaris to a place of pride and stolen it away with her own humility in the course of two simple sentences.
We go to war, Matron Mesbaris,
the Matron Mother said, squaring her shoulders to reflect the gravity of the declaration.
The Sabarax Orlaren prepares the battlefield, and House Do'Urden will lead the march from Menzo Berenzon and Cuse Orlaren.
Your mother went this way before, Matron Mesbaris warned. I am painfully aware of that,
the matron mother replied. The personal reference a reminder that she, Quenthel, had been slain on that very adventure.
Your mother sent forth the greatest army Menzo Berenzon has dispatched in the modern age, and we returned wounded, one and all. A mistake that will not be replayed, Quenthel assured her. Our force will be modest this time, for no great drow army is needed in the coming battle.
Mesbaris and the others looked at her curiously.
What goal? Mesbaris started to ask. We have a vast army already assembled and awaiting our lead, the matron mother explained. A kingdom of orcs, entrenched upon the land, that will sweep down upon the peoples of the cities and citadels in the region known as the Silver Marches. Woe to the dwarves in the mines who turned us back a century ago, and woe upon their fellows in two nearby citadels as well. Woe to the Darthir, the elves in the Moonwood, and woe to the great cities of Sunderbar and Silvery Moon. Grand claims. An army of tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, Quenthel told her. An army that was put in place for just this day. An army waiting for us to come and prod it forward. And so we will march, Mesbaris said. A collection of all the houses, or of Doerden alone. House Doerden is a creation of the Spider Queen's bite, the matron mother explained. For Lady Lolth, this action is person, a stab at the heart of a fellow goddess. All the houses will send representatives. I would expect proud Barrison Delarmco to compliment the warrior ranks. That is at your discretion, of course, though I tell you openly that House Bayenry will be well represented. By So Sumptu, who will lead this force, Mesbaris reasoned, but Quenthel shook her head. So Sumptu will not go, the matron mother said firm. She leads House Doerden in the interim only, directing Bregendierth in their work to reclaim the house. We will determine suitable leaders for this force we send, but among them... She paused and smiled.
Gromph liked that touch, noting that she had Mesbaris leaning forward in her throne.
The orcs will carry the fight to the people of the Silver Marches, and they will be led by...
Again she paused, holding the thought for many heartbeats. Her delay soon had Mesbaris's two children leaning forward eagerly.
By the son of Barrison Delarmco, the matron mother finished.
Melek Dorl?
Matron Mesbaris incredulously replied.
Lytosin Armco, Quenthel corrected. Wielding the sword of Dantrag Bayenry, marching in the name of Daemon and Eshesbernon, House Doerden. We will wreak carnage upon the Silver Marches from behind a throng of orcs. We will repay them for our defeat that century and more ago, and we will ruin the name of the apostate Drizzt to Lolth's glory.
Drizzt?
Mesbaris echoed incredulously.
I care not for Drizzt Doerden.
But the Spider Queen does, and so you shall,
the matron mother replied.
Go and pray and seek guidance. You and Teyrul and all the priestesses of your house, you will see. We are called now, there is no doubt.
Mesbaris and her daughter exchanged concerned looks. But Quenthel had them, Gromph knew, and he nodded, silently congratulating his sister, who did indeed seem more like his mother.
There is no intrigue now among us,
Matron Mother Quenthel said with a snap of finality that brooked no debate.
This is not the time.
And so House Bayenry gains two seats on the council, Mesbaris reminded, a flash of anger in her red eyes.
No,
the Matron Mother replied. So Sumptu will not remain as matron of House Doerden.
Then who?
We will know, was all that Matron Mother Quenthel would offer. But still,
House Doerden is the Matron Mother's creation, and so to the Matron Mother's control, Mesbaris reasoned.
If the son of Barriss and Delarmgo performs well, then perhaps Matron Maz Barriss too will find alliance in the reconstituted House de Werden. If Matron Maz Barriss is wise enough to properly support the quest of Lolth, of course. Perhaps then we will both have gained a second voice on the council. With that tempting tidbit, the matron mother bowed and stepped through Gromp's portal. The archmage lingered in the audience chamber for a few moments, weighing the expressions and reactions of the Armgos. I will not forget our conspiracy, or your weakness in seeing it through to fruition, Maz Barriss warned him, using her silent hand cant instead of speaking aloud, in case Quenthel could hear her on the other side of that magical door.
Go find a handmaiden and discuss the matter, Gromp replied. You will learn wisdom in my weakness, and humility to temper your dangerous pride.
He bowed and stepped through, and the magical door disappeared.
We'll not hold Luskin for long if you insist on keeping such a sizable force here in Menzo Baranzon,
Jarl Axel dared to say to Matron Mother Quenthel when she and Gromph paid him a visit in the Doerden compound. Then Iago has the city well in hand, the Matron Mother replied. Tiago is not far away, and the Zorlarans will march to his call.
Tiago is on his way back here, so it is said, although he seems to be taking his time about it, Jarl Axel replied rather slyly, tipping his hand that he might know more than his counterparts regarding the movements of the brash young warrior. Which he did not.
And are the Zorlarans not foremost in your plans to march to the east?
Jarl Axel went on.
Surely you will include Matron Zerith's garrison among your army.
Jarl Axel noted Gromph's very angry scowl. The archmage, standing behind the matron mother, even offered Jarl Axel a disgusted shake of his head to warn him away from this line of questioning. Because he had called Quenthel's bluff, Jarl Axel realized, keeping him and Bregendierth bottled up here at House de Werden would certainly leave their well-constructed network in Luskin too weak to resist any pushback from the more conventional forces up there. The other high captains would move on ship Kurth if they thought they could be rid of Beniago, and more than that, if they thought they could grab their city back from Jarl Axel's hold.
I have less than 400 soldiers, Jarl Axel elaborated. In total, more than 100 are out and about the Underdark and the surface as scouts and emissaries. You have more than 2/3 of the remaining garrison here.
Gromph held his breath, as if he expected their sister to lash out at Jarl Axel, the mercenary leader realized. But Quenthel took a long pause and seemed to be seriously considering Jarl Axel's words.
That leaves Beniago with less than 100 to hold our place among a city of thousands and thousands of veteran pirates and scalawags, Jarl Axel said.
It is said that one drow warrior is worth 100 enemies, Quenthel replied.
Many things are said, few are true, Jarl Axel dared to press. Whatever the demands of Lady Lolth in the East, it would not be wise to lose Luskin in pursuit of her favor. This is our trade route to the surface, and has already brought great wealth and power to Menzo Baranzon, including strange and mighty artifacts from the Empire of Netheril. And it is a trade route, though going straight through Cusor Lauren, which is solidly controlled by House Beanry.
Neither you nor Beniago seem eager to claim that family name, Quenthel reminded him.
Would you have us do so?
Jarl Axel asked innocently, knowing the answer, and Quenthel had to concede the point.
Through Luskin. Through my organization, you will track the trading and ultimately control the power of Cusor Lauren.
You overestimate your importance to me.
Matron Shakti Hunzarin would disagree,
Jarl Axel replied without hesitation, referring to the matron of the 11th house. Even though she was not on the ruling council, Shakti Hunzarin carried an inordinate amount of power, because House Hunzarin was among the greatest economic forces in the city, thanks to an elaborate trade network spidering out far beyond Menzo Baranzon's borders.
Matron Mother Quenthel turned and glanced at Gromp, who shrugged almost apologetically before nodding his agreement with Jarl Axel.
"You have secured the alliance with House Barriss and Delamco," Gromp reasoned. "Matron Mes Barriss is fully within your web. Given our stated alliance to House de Werden, none will dare move on House de Werden at this time without Barriss and Delamco's nod, which Matron Mes Barriss will not dare give."
Quenthel settled comfortably then, mulling it over. "May I return to Luskin?" Jarl Axel asked after a short silence.
"No,"
the matron mother sharply replied, and then more calmly. "No, but you may return half your foot soldiers from House de Werden back to Beniago's command."
"I am to join the procession to the east, then,"
Jarl Axel said, with enough of a sigh to show that he would consider that a tedious task indeed.
"No,"
Quenthel said flatly. Her answer surprised the mercenary. From everything she had said and everything he had heard elsewhere, the work in the East would be that of diplomacy more than combat, after all. And who better for that task than Jarl Axel?
"It will not be a large force that we send to the East," the matron mother explained.
But perceptive Jarl Axel heard something else in her dodge, something personal regarding him, he suspected.
"Our posture there is as advisers, directing the Orc thousands. I'll not repeat Ivanel's mistake. Win or lose in the Silver Marches, the price will not be high to Menzo Berenson."
"You are stirring a wasp's nest," Jarl Axel warned.
"And letting the wasps bite where they may," Quenthel agreed.
Jarl Axel mulled that over for a bit. The idea that Menzo Berenson would start a war and care so little about the outcome did not seem correct to him. Not at all. He considered his surroundings and considered the target. He spent a long while studying Quenthel. What about this Drizzt? Drizzt had once killed Quenthel, after all, and quite painfully.
"House de Werden will lead the fight in the east, but you will remain right here by my side and at my call,"
Quenthel said flatly. Because of his relationship with Drizzt, Jarl Axel understood but did not dare say. The mercenary bowed, recognizing the meeting to be at its end.
"So the march against the Silver Marches will be led by Tosin, the patron of House de Werden,"
Gromp said to Quenthel when they were back in his quarters at House Beanry.
"And by Tiago, weapons master of House Beanry."
"Well reasoned," Quenthel replied. "And where is the prideful whelp?"
"He will be along," Gromp assured her. "Will you send Sosumtu to the east?"
he asked, eager to change the subject, for he did not want to fill the volatile Quenthel in on Tiago's excursion to Icewind Dale.
"Mes Barriss already asked as much."
"Tell me personally," Gromp bade her.
"No,"
she answered after pausing for a moment to take a close measure of Gromp.
"Priestess Sarabel will, sir."
"How many of our house will go?"
"Few," Quenthel replied. "The city will send perhaps 100 warriors in total, with a score of that number from House Barriss and Delarmgo, and the rest of the ranks filled with weapons masters of lesser houses, eager to make their reputation. The contingent of priestesses, again from lesser houses, will serve Sarabel, and Cusor Lauren will supply the contingent of wizards, all of them save one."
"Me,"
the archmage remarked. And he made sure he didn't sound enthusiastic about the possibility.
"Nay, your lackey,"
Quenthel corrected to his surprise and delight.
"Whoever you decide that to be, your duty is simple, my archmage. You keep a direct line open to Tiago's fortress in the east, wherever he makes it. We would converse with him regularly on the prosecution of the war, and we will go to him with a sizable force if necessary, or recall him if prudent. I'll not lose Tiago in this excursion."
"Because he will help House de Werden rise to legitimate promise, affording you a second vote on the ruling council at your will,"
Gromp replied.
"After our glory in the east, House de Werden will ascend in rank, favored by Lolf.
Quenthel agreed. And Gromph understood then that Quenthel was determined about two things in the East, that Tiago would not fall and that Tosin Armgo would. He saluted his clever sister with a bow.
Chapter 24 The Fighter Beside You. In life, stealth had never been Thibbledorf Puente's greatest strength. Quite the contrary, the ferocious battle rager usually took great pride in announcing his presence to his enemies long before battle was joined, even if that meant a few arrows or spears flying his way during his inevitable charge. Not so in death, however, for Puente's vampirism afforded him a congruence with the shadows that he could use as a great advantage, along with a lightness to his step, enhanced by his coexistence within two forms, solid and gaseous, and two planes of existence. He was hunting among and against the dark elves, the masters of darkness, the silent killers, whose domain was the eternal night of the Underdark. And so the vampire had honed his craft to perfection now, so he believed. He wove around the drow and the goblins and the half-drow, half-spider abominations with impunity. They couldn't find him, couldn't begin to even sense him, save the shivers that coursed their spines from the chill of his proximity, or the tiny hairs standing along their arms or at the back of their necks as he passed just below their conscious senses. Puente had murdered a score of drow, and taken nearly half of those as undead minions, and he had feasted liberally on the blood of goblin slaves many times. Yes, this was his domain now, for none alive knew the ways of Gontalgrim better than he. Every corridor, every broken crack, both from the sheer age of the complex and from the volcanic eruption when the primordial had found a decade of freedom, was known to him. Never was he out of place here, for this was his place. He fancied himself the steward of Gontalgrim, the protector of the dwarven homeland. He knew that to be half of his existence, at least, even while he hated the other half, the darker half, the half that could turn him against even Brunner, his king of old. He wanted to suppress that darkness now, he reminded himself as he crouched at the corner of a four-way intersection. His king was close, he knew, along with the others, and they too were friends of Gontalgrim, though he knew not how or why or where he had once known them, if he had at all.
"Me king,"
he silently mouthed. But he ended with a sneer, and it was all he could do to stop that twisted scowl from becoming an audible, feral snarl. He couldn't take a deep breath, of course, since he no longer drew breath, but Puente settled himself more comfortably on his feet, as if allowing the gaseous aspects of his form to solidify. He eagerly rolled his fingers together, his ridged and spiked gauntlets squeaking slightly with the rub. He knew where they were, and understood where he could set an ambush with his dead drow minions.
"Me king,"
he mouthed again, pointedly reminding himself that he didn't want to set an ambush. Or did he? He glanced back, thinking how clever it would be to summon his undead drow minions, and he noted movement as he turned just slightly, just out of the corner of his eye, and so close that he knew he could be struck before he could react. How had the dark elves gotten so close? What scout was this? He turned around to face the would-be assassin, and allowed a growl to escape his lips, and moved as if to pounce. But he did not, for Drizzt Do'Urden stepped out before him. Puente eyed him carefully, shocked that he had gotten so close so easily, so invisibly, so silently. The dark elf ranger hadn't drawn his scimitars, the magical blades resting comfortably at his hips. The vampire's roving eye met Drizzt's gaze, and Puente let another soft growl escape his lips.
"I left you in a cave," Drizzt said.
"As a friend. In trust."
"Then yourself's a fool,"
the dwarf replied. Am I? The Thibbledorf Puente I once knew was no coward. As the insult registered, Puente threw himself at the drow. Out came Drizzt's blades in a flash, cutting and stabbing, it seemed, before they had even lifted from their respective scabbards. Despite his rage, despite his condition,